DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Welcome to DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories. I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany. On this week's show, we take you to the Syrian city of Kobane to meet two weapons dealers who are restocking their shelves with groceries. Plus, the Bangladeshi unionist and activist who started working in her country's vast garment industry as a 12-year-old and ended up being blacklisted for life.
We need these jobs, but we want these jobs with dignity. Next time you go to the store, please start ask more questions to the store managers that you want to buy these clothes, but in the same time you want to know more about the person who make clothes for you.
That and more coming up on today's Worldlink. You're listening to DW's Worldlink with me, Neil King, and we start this week's programme in Syria. Having fought off IS forces in 2015, the Kurds of northern Syria are now facing a new aggressor, Turkey. Turkish forces took control of the Kurdish town of Afrin last month in an operation aimed at curbing Kurdish power so close to the Turkish border. Turkey claims the Kurdish militia controlling parts of northern Syria, the YPG, are terrorists, and Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has repeatedly threatened to continue military operations against them in other Kurdish-held towns bordering on Turkey. But further east, in the autonomous Kurdish region, in the city of Kobane, a semblance of normality is returning, 3 years after a lengthy and deadly battle against IS. Locals continue to rebuild residential neighbourhoods, shops are open and people are able to go about their daily business. But many still feel the need to be ready to defend themselves should their city come under threat again. DW's Phil Warwick spoke to two weapons dealers in Kobane about how the city has moved on and what the future holds for gun control in this part of Syria.
As the evening draws to an end and the orange-crimson sunset colours fall over Kobane, Farid tends his shop, where he sells a variety of chocolate snacks, tea, coffee, cigarettes and soft drinks. The premises are simple-looking, three concrete walls with a shutter facing the main street, one of many generic-looking businesses in this de facto autonomous region of northern Syria. Prior to any serious conversation taking place, Farid offers me a coffee. Nothing can start without the customary tea or coffee, and here at Farid's shop, this is no different. Now and again, someone pops in to purchase an item or two. Farid started to sell weapons back in 2014 when IS's threat grew in the region, which culminated in the Battle of Kobane. Farid fought in the battle. Weapons were smuggled over the Turkish border and through the corrupt Free Syrian Army. In Kobane, the light weapons could be bought from shop owners or someone would bring the weapons to YPG fighters. Gun permits were not rigorously enforced at the time, since the police force of the autonomous cantons within the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria was small. But when did the idea materialize to start selling weapons?
Prior to weapon smuggling, I had a large market and had a license to sell gas cylinders, and I was happy with that income. But later, the Syrian pound dropped in value against the dollar. That's when I started to buy weapons off the Free Syrian Army and sell them to our Kurdish brothers here. This was good business. But now that the weapons market has gone quiet again, I've returned to selling goods.
With his business doing well and no real threat in and around Kobane, Farid says he doesn't sell weapons anymore, though he didn't say what and how many weapons he owns, nor how exactly the weapons were smuggled over the Turkish border.
With the beginning of the revolution, weapons came from Aleppo and Homs. These weapons were bought from the Free Syrian Army and from smugglers coming across the Turkish border.
The Kurds fought IS during a 5-month battle over Kobane, which ended in 2015. Those weeks of fighting are still very much ingrained in the Kurdish psyche. They fought tooth and nail for each street corner and house.
On June 25th, 2015,
there was a massacre in Kobane. One of the reasons for the massacre is that people didn't have weapons to protect themselves. People are afraid of this happening again. That's why they have bought guns.
So, how much is a weapon?
The buying and selling of weapons is much slower and quieter now. A 7mm Czech Republic Star is 200,000 Syrian pounds. That's about $400. There are also many types of Kalashnikovs with prices ranging from $200 to $400. A 14-bullet gun, which we call a standard, is $1,000.
The average wage in the de facto autonomous region of northern Syria is in the region of $50 per month. Farid didn't say how much he earned in selling weapons. 30-year-old Korker Mustafa comes from the west countryside of Kobane. He was a gun dealer, but recently, with the stabilization of the region, demand for weapons has dropped. Mustafa now works as a driver. He stopped selling guns a while ago. He says he doesn't need a gun in Kobane as it is safe, but he takes it with him when traveling to other areas in the northern autonomous region. Over the past 2 years, he's come across some unusual weapons.
Kalashnikovs made in East Germany, the Soviet Union and China. NATO-issue pistols used in the Turkish army. The oldest model I saw was a Kalashnikov 56, and also a Kalashnikov that was produced more than 30 years ago. That's older than me.
Kobane, for some time now, has experienced a period of peace and tranquility, as opposed to other Syrian cities, where the region's volatility still presents clear dangers to civilians. Farid explains why he thinks people still need weapons.
Because a lot of people live in villages near the Turkish border, and we cannot trust the Turkish side because they open fire on our side. Just a month ago, they injured some of our fighters. So people, especially in that area, buy weapons and guns to protect themselves.
Farid understands that EU countries have rigorous gun laws, that there are checks and controls when acquiring a weapon, stringent procedures and psychological tests prior to a person being granted a gun license. Mustafa says this procedure is a good thing in newly liberated areas such as Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor.
In newly liberated areas, people still dress ISIS style. Men there still have long beards. If we give people in those areas gun permits, they might end up using these guns against us. Their minds are still sullied by ISIS propaganda. You can never trust these people.
I ask Farid how he, a former arms dealer, feels about the fact that weapons and guns, such as those he's been selling, have killed hundreds of thousands of people in Syria. Does this weigh on his conscience at all?
We cannot say that the weapon is only bad. In Islam, there's a saying, you sell a weapon, that's haram or forbidden. But maybe this weapon will protect you. For example, when ISIS came here in June 2015, those with guns were able to protect themselves. Those without, they died. They lost their life.
Mustafa adds his 5 cents.
The Kurds have many enemies and they need to protect themselves. The world has many ways of doing this, just like a flower that has thorns to protect itself.
Both men now say they don't need the money from selling weapons, and that if there's peace in the area. As Farid concludes, inshallah, weapons take out lives, make our lives short. Philip Warwick, DW, Kobane.
The global fashion industry is valued at about $3 trillion, and though the abysmal working conditions in Asian sweatshops, which produce the bulk of the world's clothing, have been known for years, progress on improving workers' rights and pay have been sluggish, to say the least. The plight of Asian garment factory workers received huge media attention in the wake of the 2013 Rana Plaza disaster in Bangladesh. 5 years ago this month, over 1,000 people died when the overcrowded 8-storey complex collapsed. The disaster cast the spotlight not only on the shady dealings of factory owners, but also on harsh and inhumane working conditions in this key industry, which accounts for 80% of the country's exports. Which brings us to Miss Kalpona Akhtar, a well-known union leader and activist from Bangladesh. At the age of 12, she was forced to leave school and start work in a garment factory to help feed her family. Today, she heads the Bangladesh Centre for Worker Solidarity that is fighting for workers' rights in the garment industry. I met up with her as she was passing through Bonn earlier this week to talk about her fight for justice and dignity, a fight that has earned her both threats and recognition. I started the interview by asking her to take us back to that day when she entered the factory for her first shift as a 12-year-old.
I told my full name. They don't care about even my last name. Okay, Kalpona, how old are you? Then I said, I'm 12. That was fine with them. Another guy, he came and he took me to the third floor. And when I ended up going in the third floor, the sound together I heard, I never heard that sound together. That was the biggest sound I ever heard. So they were yelling to the women and was hurry, hurry, hurry. So they ended up to take me next to a person who was sewing the clothes. So, okay, your job is to cut these loops and extra fabrics from this pant. And this is the first time I, you know, working was with a scissor, like a real scissor, that hurts my, you know, fingers. Like these three fingers were swelling after the work shift. So the first day when I started, it was like the 10 a.m. to it was 10:30 p.m. shift. I was standing in my feet whole day, and then I went home, and my mom asked that, how was the day? I know she was feeling sad, but I didn't do any complaint. I was said okay, but I didn't show that my fingers was hurt. So that was my first day.
And the next day you had to go back again, and this was a start of a new life for you, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, so next day, and then, you know, never stopping. So it was a new start of my life. So every day I would go to the factory in the same time. As I said, my friends would go to the school and they would ask me, where are you going? And I would
say, you weren't going to school anymore?
No, I never been to school after that. And when I switched my factory after 6 months, it was like more worse. It was 16 hours, very common. Even I was working over 400 hours in a month and making only $6. And later, my 10-year-old brother had to join with me because that wages was not enough for 7 person in the family.
And you said your mother was also sad. Was this hard for your parents that they had to take you out of school and send you to work?
It was so hard for my parents. I definitely, you know, could feel that. My dad was the primary earner in the family, and he got ill and he couldn't work. He couldn't work after that. He was in bed for 14 years as a paralyzed. And my mom, she started working in the factory, but she had to quit after 6 months because she had an infant at home. My baby sister was only 2 months old, so she couldn't continue. So it was so hard for my parents. That could be like with any parents, but they hadn't had any choice.
Was there any particular eye-opening experience that you made in the factory that sort of made you want to change all this for yourself, and also because you're also helping to change the lot of others? Was there any sort of moment when you realized, okay, this has to stop and I'm going to do something about this now?
Yes. So I was working, since I started working, 2.5 years, I was working in this sweatshop condition without knowing the law and rights. 1 month, it was during Eid festival, we supposed to get our overtime payment before that. And management come with the idea that they will pay us less for overtime. Even they would already paying less. And we said no, because I had a plan with that money. It is a festival and I need to buy clothes for, you know, new clothes for my brother and sister, whatever I can, whatever I could afford. And I said, no, you cannot do that. So do the other workers. So we were in a 2 units. We were approximately 1,500 workers was working in that factory. So it was 93 frontline striker who called a strike. And it was 92 men, young age men, who can be like in their 20s or 25. And I was only a teenager who joined with them. It's not that I was brave. It's not that I know the law. It's because I had to have that money. The management started firing the strikers, the frontline strikers. So they started with 23 of them who got fired, but they were like smarter. They were looking for an organization where they can get help and sue the factory owner. So they ended up finding an organization called, today they call Solidarity Center. They're the international wing for AFL-CIO, which is American biggest union. So that organization was helping a group of female workers to form their independent union, helping workers with the legal aid support, and so do also helping workers to get to know the law. So they're running the level of training. So my co-workers got the training and came back to us and said, there is something new we did. We sued the factory owner. I was like, what is that? And they said, oh, there is something different, that there is a law, you should learn that. And I was like, what is that? And they said, you should come. So weeks or later, I've been with them. I went for that level of training. And it was 4 hours long training, which changed my entire life.
Just 4 hours?
It is just 4 hours. And I consider it's a second born for me. There I learned my work shift is supposed to be 8 hours. I shouldn't be forced for overtime. I should pay double for overtime. My supervisor shouldn't slap on me for a minor mistake or shouldn't kick me.
Did that happen a lot?
That happened. That used to happen a lot. And my working place should be safe. If there is a fire in the factory, they shouldn't put me locked in the production floor, which they did. So there should be emergency exit my factory. There should be hygiene toilet. There should be a drinking water. And something beautiful I learned, that I can organize and I can bargain with my factory owners. I was like, whew. These factory owners whom I thought that they are so kind and they give me a job so I could feed my family, literally they were cheating over me. They are doing the worst theft for many years. So I started sharing this with my coworkers from following day and educating them that what I learned. And I took them to the level of training as well in the same place I've been to. And together, we started organizing the union. And in the age of 16, or close to 16, I became a union president in my shop floor.
I must admit, I have no idea what clothes I'm wearing today, where they were produced or what the conditions were under which they were produced. And I guess there are actually many in the West like me. Mm-hmm. Given your activism and also your history, how does this make you feel that there's so many people in the West buying products which perhaps contribute to suffering in your home country?
Okay, I will respond in a different way. Okay, first of all, it is not good that you buying clothes without knowing who making clothes for you. Okay. Second is, as an activist or a labor advocate, why I'm going around the world, it is to educate the consumers, to let them know we need these jobs, but we want these jobs with dignity. Next time you go to the store, please start ask more questions to the store managers that you want to buy these clothes, but in the same time, you want to know more about the person who make clothes for you. Make it personal, because somebody making it beautiful. So start ask that you want to know more that how much these workers has been paid. Do they have living wage? Do they have union rights at those workplaces? Those workplaces are safe for them? And is this gender-based violence free? Your voice will be matters. It will ring bell in the boss's offices. Buy less, pay more.
Final question. That little girl that went into the factory back then as a 12-year-old, what would you tell her today? Would you tell her, don't go in? Or would you say, go in because it was necessary that she went in because it enabled her to fight it from the outside later, that she had to make that experience? What would you tell her?
That little girl today is 41 years old. I would echo basically what my mom said. If there is injustice, someone can always stand up and speak out. If it was someone, why not me? If it is someone, why not you? So next time when you see injustice, just stand up and speak out. That will make difference. That will make change the world.
Many thanks to the Bangladeshi unionist leader and activist Kalpona Akhtar there. We now come to our regular Worldlink columnist and radiant mother of five, Tamsin Walker. I mention this because with five kids, Tamsin is way above the national average. But maybe things are changing in Germany's maternity wards. After years, decades even, of a sluggish birth rate, Germany has announced the highest number of births per woman since 1973. The average number of children is now just over 1.5, according to the latest figures, and it's rising. That's been welcomed here, but also held up as a warning to national and state-level governments to ensure the necessary infrastructure is in place to support these children in society. So, time for Worldlink columnist Tamsin Walker to give us a cautionary tale of her own.
So it's happened at last. Germany has started producing more babies. Although, as the small print this news states, the 2016 increase of 54,000 squalling infants isn't enough to offer long-term population stability, it is enough, for now at least, to quiet a noise about a shrinking population. A toast, then, to all the foreign women and Germans in their 30s who've been doing their bit effectively enough to buck a trend so stubbornly sluggish that Angela Merkel's various governments have introduced a succession of financial and childcare incentives to promote procreation. But no, don't pop the corks just yet, for riding on the fragile back of what many see as a cause for celebration, or some 790,000 of them to be more precise, are warnings about shortages of daycare centres, school places and midwives.
What do you want to show me?
This is where you were born. You were once that small, like that baby on the picture.
Was that small?
Yeah.
When I had my last and final child, I decided to go to the hospital alone. Remembering earlier births in which a midwife seemed to be present more or less throughout, I blindly assumed that capable and cheerful company would be on hand to talk away the pain, seeing as how drugs had previously never been on offer. Turns out that was a romantic fantasy. There was no soothing chat, just moments stolen from women screaming out of other delivery rooms. According to the Association of Midwives in Berlin, that scenario has become standard, with a single midwife tending to as many as six women at once. And given that they're responsible for ensuring a safe passage into the world for both mother and child, that workload has become untenable and, moreover, dangerous. Under a 10-point action plan for a good and safe birth, the city is now proposing more training places, investment in new maternity facilities, and improved working conditions. Without them, the increase in the number of infants is just daunting.
Yeah, but you can't do jars since there are only two food, I think.
After that last and final birth of mine 6 years ago, I remember a nurse telling me I'd done my bit for the German birth rate. She was by no means the first or the last. I get it a lot, by turns with raised eyebrows, sarcasm, and awkward pats on the back. And it doesn't stop there. Having a larger-than-average family invites reams of questions and comments, some plainly inappropriate. The most common of the bunch is how I mother five kids. That question stumps me. All I've got is that I make it up as I go along. I'm not a planner, and our home is not a place of particular structure, though it's not anarchy either. Maybe it's a simple case of following my instincts as opposed to advice on the pages of myriad books about surviving, regretting, or embracing motherhood.
Pregnant at last, pregnancy and birth, my pregnancy, the mama book.
I've never bought or read such a book, and I'm confident I never will, but I know they're out there in abundance, cooing in their cutesy covers from the shelves of equally abundant pastel shops devoted to all things baby. Most of them unnecessary. Oh yes, because though Germany's birth rate has been slow to grow, the industry around it has exploded. Seducing the pregnant to indulge in maternity yoga, massage, pilates, hairdressing and workshops on what to expect, and luring new mothers into a sense of insecurity. Watching from the sidelines of playgrounds, kindergartens and classrooms, I've seen the emergence of unaffordable prams, breastfeeding scarves, designer baby and kid wear, and mothers so convinced they have to do it right, in inverted commas, that they become stressed, nervous and almost incapable of enjoying themselves or their kids. And as I've watched, I've wondered, at times loudly and profusely, why the sudden fuss about the one thing we've categorically been doing since the earliest of beginnings.
Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off more than I could chew, but through it all, when there was dark,
without wishing to sound like your grandmother, it wasn't like that when I had my first kid, or my second. But all too often, it is that way now. I hope that as, when, and if my bunch should ever make their own contribution to the German birth rate, the warnings about the need for more midwives, daycare, and schools will have been heeded. But I hope, too, that they hear my own warning to keep the parenting industry at arm's length, and make at least some of it up as they go along.
Many thanks to Worldlink columnist Tamsin Walker in Berlin there. And I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany. Stay with us. You're listening to DW's Worldlink. I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, we've got a report from India's Rajasthan region. A group of women there is fighting for government compensation after their husbands died from a deadly lung disease as a result of working in dangerous conditions in the local stone quarries.
Our children also work in the quarries and will suffer the same fate. They don't have a future. Nothing is changing, and I've lost half my life in the quarries.
But first, in the small West African country of Togo, the belief in witchcraft is widespread. A survey by the US-based pollster Gallup found that just over half of sub-Saharan Africans believe in the practice. It's often seen as the cause for anything unusual, from sickness to crop failure. Those accused of being witches or wizards are abused and ostracized and are usually among the most vulnerable in society. Many of them are children. Reporter Laura Salm-Reiferscheid went to Togo to find out more.
I was born in Titigbe, in the center of Togo. I spent my childhood there, played with my friends. My brother was also there, and my father. Then my father died. He told me that if he dies, I should stay with my brother. My mother wasn't with me then.
When Martino's father died 6 years ago, and his half-brother became the man of the house, his carefree life as he knew it suddenly ended. As the slim 19-year-old recounts his story, he sits on a plastic chair outside his mother's little house, just off the road that leads to Sokodé, a dusty city in the north of Togo.
My brother threatened me all the time. We lived with his mother, my stepmother. When there was work to do, it was always me who had to do it. It wasn't my brother or my sister, but me who was there. My brother was somewhere else, and he said if there was anything to do, I had to do it. So I did it all. One day, he had a motorbike accident and broke his foot. He came home and said that I had done it to him. I said I knew nothing about it, but he said it was me.
Martino's half-brother blamed the then 13-year-old boy of being a wizard and using his supernatural powers to make the motorbike crash. In Togo, like in many other countries around the world, belief in witchcraft is widespread. People of all strata of society, religions and ethnic groups believe in it. It is said that witches and wizards gain their power by a spell or it is passed from mother to child. They then use it to wreak havoc at night when they turn into animals, often an owl or another bird. Accidents, snake bites, sudden death, illnesses, infertility, harvest failures, and many other problems are believed to have a spiritual origin and can be reasons to accuse somebody of witchcraft.
One day we got up at 4:30 to harvest millet. We arrived there at 7. My brother called me and attacked me. He asked, "Do you want to live or die?" "I want to live," I said. He said he was suffering because of his broken foot and that I should suffer too.
Martina says his half-brother bound his hands and feet to a pole, just like a hunter does to carry his prey, and left him lying in the sun. He beat him and rubbed chili into his eyes. Then, after 4 days, he took Martina into the bush, untied his legs and told him to run. But because of the tight ropes, the blood circulation in his hands and feet had stopped. He couldn't get up. By the time somebody found Martina and took him to hospital, the wounds on his hands and feet had gone putrid. His right hand, some fingers on his left hand, and a part of his foot had to be amputated. Creuset Togo, a local children's rights NGO, heard his story, took him in and paid for his treatment.
Donc pour Martina, quand il était guéri, il était tellement traumatisé, il ne voulait plus voir quelqu'un autour de lui.
When Martina's wounds had healed, he was so traumatized, he didn't want to see anybody around him. It was the psychological support that really helped to improve his frame of mind. We thought about what he could do. When he talked about himself, he said that he was good for nothing and asked why he should go on living.
Pourquoi il doit vivre?
Ali Dou is a social worker with Creuset Togo. He still remembers well when Martina came to the NGO's transit center after almost 5 months in hospital. The center, which is called Kandia, or the protector in the local Kabir language, lies on a quiet sandy street on the outskirts of Sokodé. Here, children who are homeless, victims of trafficking or violence, and those accused of witchcraft find a temporary refuge. They stay until they can be reintegrated into their own families or placed with relatives or foster family. Since opening in August 2012, the center has welcomed around 540 children. Nearly 350 were so-called witch children.
Oui, dans les familles, ces enfants vraiment sont mutilés, ils sont maltraités.
These children are mutilated, mistreated, beaten, and they're often exposed to danger. If it rains, they are sent into the rain. If there's hot sun, they send them into the heat. And if there is hail, it is them they send. Just to say, it is tough luck if something happens to them, even if they die, because there is nobody there to defend them. They aren't valued. They're excluded from society.
Ils ne sont pas considérés. Ils sont exclus de la société.
Most often women and children are accused of witchcraft, but people who are seen as having no function in society are also targeted. The old, the mentally ill, outcasts. Children of single or divorced parents, from dysfunctional families, or from fathers who have more than one wife are most vulnerable. Ali Dou says poverty also compounds the problem.
Mais seulement ce que nous savons, les études menées sur le terrain.
What we know from our experience is that some children are only accused of witchcraft because they don't have a father or a mother, and there isn't anybody to defend them. So we've seen, for example, that it's difficult for people to accuse someone like me of witchcraft because I'm strong, I work. So if somebody tries to attack me with these accusations, they won't stick.
Quand quelqu'un essaie de m'attaquer de cette manière, je ne vais pas lui laisser.
He says accusations of witchcraft are also sometimes directed at children who appear to be especially gifted.
Ils ont des capacités mentales vraiment très développées et ils font des choses miraculeuses.
Those who are very intelligent and can do amazing things. So, for example, if they're asked to explain something and give a really good answer, they are said to be possessed. Or if they have a promising future, it can be ruined by an accusation of witchcraft. The many children we receive here are not witches. People tell us that if you touch them, you die immediately. But we eat together, we play together, and we haven't seen any of those things they're accused of. What we know about these children is that they are gifted and incredibly intelligent. And if they're being taken care of properly, they are normal, just like all the other kids.
The children at the center have just finished their lunch. They're chatting, laughing and playing in the yard. Some of them are reading to their friends or drawing on a large blackboard under an open pavilion. There are currently around 30 children between the ages of 6 and 17 living here. And each of them has a harrowing tale to tell.
Witches eat people at night. They kill them and eat them at night.
Marcela knows what witches and wizards are capable of. He's heard it too many times. The boy himself was accused of being a wizard after his grandfather's goats and chickens dropped dead one by one. The grandfather beat his grandson, warning his friends to stay away. The 11-year-old ran away from home several times before he found refuge at the center. His mother lives in the capital, Lomé, in the south of the country. But he says she stopped visiting him after his grandfather told her she had a wizard for a child. Marcelin nervously plays with a piece of paper in his hands as he speaks in his soft voice about his mother.
Quand je l'appelle de venir me prendre, elle refuse. Elle ne veut pas me prendre.
When I called her to come and get me, she refused. Her husband says she doesn't want to see me there with my mother in Lomé. I don't know why. Now when I call her, she doesn't pick up the phone. I don't know why.
Eleven-year-old Pascal also lives at the center. He used to live on the street and work for a woman at the market, until she accused him of stealing. To drive the evil from him, he says she cut the back of his legs with a razor blade and rubbed chili into the fresh wounds. And then there's Rabi, a shy 13-year-old girl. Her grandmother accused her of being a witch and beat her with a wooden bat, leaving a scar on the back of her head. Rabi says her grandmother took her to a healer to exorcise her and just left her there. For 1.5 years, she was forced to work for the healer, harvesting his fields, collecting herbs and roots for his concoctions. In Togo, it's not unusual for healers to try to make money out of the helplessness and ignorance of parents trying to cure their children. One healer further north of Sokodé tells me that he charges 120,000 West African francs, so more than 180 euros, to exorcise a child. Also, with the rise of religious movements such as Pentecostalism in sub-Saharan Africa since the late 1980s, the accusations of children is said to have increased. The self-proclaimed prophets of these churches not only identify witches, but also promise deliverance to the possessed, also in exchange for money. Here's Alidou at the center again.
In every corner and region, you find these healers and prayer camps. They all do the same, exploit children. They send the children to the fields to work for them and pay them nothing for the work. There are many forms of exploitation. There are cases of rape as well, and some girls get pregnant at these places. We can't find out who raped them because they trap the girls, put a bag over their head so they can't be identified, and then rape them.
On prend un sac, on porte la tête de l'enfant et puis on le viole.
Not all children can be reintegrated into their families. Often parents or relatives are reluctant to take back a so-called witch child. Martina, the boy that was beaten and tied up by his half-brother, was eventually reunited with his mother. Cruzet Togo found her in neighboring Benin. Now she's settled near Sokodé to look after her son.
I gave birth to him. Where does this leave me? He's my only child now. He's like a duck that had its wings clipped. It can only swim, but it cannot fly. I don't know what to do.
The haggard woman looks much older than her 45 years. Martina started to breed rabbits to contribute to the meager income his mother earns by selling homemade soy cheese on the roadside next to the house. But with one hand amputated and disfigured fingers on the other hand, he finds it hard to do all the chores by himself. Martina's mother is worried about her son and about her own future. As the youngest child, he was supposed to one day look after her. Now she has to take care of him. And she's deeply troubled by how Martina's half-brother treated him.
He doesn't want to see me, but I want to see him. I don't care. He doesn't know that what he did was bad. Otherwise, he wouldn't have done it. I will forgive him. Only God knows what I feel.
Martina and his mother haven't seen the half-brother again. He fled from the police and to this day is a fugitive. But Martina is not one to dwell on the past. He now wants to look forward.
I have forgiven him, but he will be judged. They will arrest him and judge him. I am content. Life with my mother is good.
For DW, Laura Salm-Reiferscheid in Sokodé, Togo.
It's to India now, where in Rajasthan, in the country's north, a job in one of the region's stone quarries can turn out to be a death sentence. Many people working there develop a lung disease after breathing in the stone dust. The disease kills, and stone workers' families are left struggling to make a living. Now, some of their widows are coming together to demand a better future. Yulia Werawan travelled to the village of Budpura to meet them. Her report is presented by Keith Walker.
A small, bright crowd has gathered in front of the temple at Bodhpura in the Indian state of Rajasthan. Some 80 women talk excitedly. They are dressed in saris of all colours and have pulled part of the cloth over their heads like a shelter from the midday sun. It's nearly 40 degrees Celsius. Usually the women retreat to the shade of the stone huts at this time of day until it's cooler, but today they're on a mission. These women are widows. Their husbands are victims of the stone industry. Because so many men here have died, places like Budpura are also dubbed widows' villages.
I'll come at the back. That's okay.
Today the women are headed to Bundi, the closest city. They squeeze into four minibuses for a 90-minute journey. The state governor is due to visit the city today. The women want to intercept her and draw her attention to their fate, the fate of women like Hira Bai.
My name is Hira Bai. My husband was Hari Singh. He died of silicosis 2 years ago.
Hira Bai's husband worked in the stone quarries around Budpura. Like for many of his colleagues, his work cost him his life. He suffered from silicosis, a deadly lung disease caused by the inhalation of fine dust particles.
6 months before he died, he was complaining constantly about breathing difficulties. Many of us here have similar breathing problems, so we didn't take it too seriously. But he always said, "No, this feels like I can't breathe at all."
Here are chisels, paving stones. It's not enough to earn a living, and incomes have decreased.
The stones used to belong to us, We collected rubble from the quarries and made paving stones out of it. We got 2.5 or 3 rupees for each stone. But now the mine owners provide the stones, and they only pay 1 rupee, 1 rupee 10 or 1 rupee 20 for each stone.
That development has left the women feeling exploited, but they don't have a choice. This is the only way to earn money.
Our children also work in the quarries and will suffer the same fate. They don't have a future. Nothing is changing, and I've lost half my life in the quarries.
In Bundi, rain cools the hot asphalt. People seek shelter under the tea stands and the awnings of houses. But Hira and the other women brave the downpour. They walk along a narrow street towards the building that houses the city administration, chanting, "Give us our rights." They are demanding money, compensation for their deceased husbands. Hira and another woman are also carrying a large banner which reads, "The Widows of Budpura." The next day, back in the village of Budpura, 55-year-old Radha Bai squats on gravel on the floor, chipping away at a grey stone. She was one of the widows at a protest in Bundi yesterday. Now, with a hammer and chisel in hand, she carves a big stone slab into shape, her turquoise sari striking a stark contrast with the drab surroundings. Her hands work quickly, each stroke precise.
I've been working in stone mines and the stone industry for 35 years. First, I transported stone. Then, for the last 20 years, I've been making paving stones because it means I can do the work here while sitting down.
Budpura lies at the centre of India's paving stone industry. Most of the production is exported overseas, including to Europe and countries like Germany. Sold under the name Kandla Grey, these sandstone blocks are used, for example, to pave terrace floors or garden areas. Radha Bai lives with her 3 daughters and 3 grandchildren in a simple stone hut perched on a small hillside. They have 2 rooms and 1 bed. To get to work every morning, Radha walks 10 minutes down to a small valley behind the village. Small parasols mark the places where the women work. Here and there, trees sprout from the dry gravel. Radha sits under one of them, breaking the rock.
There are quarries all around the village. You can see the trucks. They all come from there, loaded with stones. And they unload them here so that we can chisel and sculpt them. All the quarries around here mine stone.
The whole region depends on the stone industry. India produces about 1/4 of the world's natural stone. Only China produces more. On the one hand, this is good for locals. The boom in the Indian building sector and the export business have helped to create millions of jobs. On the other hand, it's dangerous work that kills many workers because the dust created by splitting the rock can be deadly in the long run. Radha Bai is sick because of the dust she's been exposed to for years.
I have silicosis. I'm very sick.
Silicosis is caused by the inhalation of silica, tiny particles of dust found in most natural stones. Sandstone, for example, has a lot of it, and it gets released when the stones break. In Germany, silicosis has been classed as an occupational disease since 1929. In India, it's also compulsory to report to the authorities, but awareness about silicosis and the grave dangers it's posing is only growing slowly.
We didn't know what it was. Then Ramesh came and took us to the doctor. He told us that we had silicosis. That was the first time we heard the name of this disease.
Radha says that was 4 years ago. Ramesh, a worker from the local NGO, came to the village and took people to the nearest university hospital. According to Indian law, silicosis patients are eligible to receive financial compensation. But in order to get help, those who are effective must prove they've worked with stone. But that's difficult because most people here don't have work contracts. In 2013, the Indian state of Rajasthan set up an independent fund to provide silicosis victims with compensation. Patients get a one-off payment of 100,000 rupees. The equivalent of around 1,300 euros, while their surviving family members are entitled to around 4,000 euros. Because Radha suffers from silicosis herself, she received a one-off payment. As a widow, she also gets a small pension. But if she had to live on it, she says she'd starve to death before the disease kills her. She earns about €1.30 per square metre of paving stone. That same candle grey paving stone is sold for at least €30 in Germany. As is so often the case in the global retail chain, it's the poorest workers right at the bottom of the production chain who get the smallest share of profits. Radha is demanding more support. She says she wants the money her family is entitled to when she dies to be paid before then.
What good is the money when I'm dead? I'm living now. If I can have the money now, then I can at least live better now. After all, I'm the one who's ill.
Dr. Vinod Jangid is a lung expert. For the past 3 years, he's been working at the university hospital in Kota, a small town about 50 kilometres from Bhutpura.
There is no cure for silicosis right now because the fine particles deposit into the lungs and that cannot be removed. Only we can reduce the inflammation and treat the second infection.
Each week, Jangid diagnoses and treats up to 8 silicosis cases. Since Rajasthan set up the compensation fund in 2013, more than 8,400 cases have been compensated. According to a study by the government's Medical Research Council, doctors detected silicosis in every second quarry worker tested. NGOs estimate that there are at least 800,000 affected miners in Rajasthan alone. On top of that, there are the paving stone workers like Radha and the children working in the stone industry. Urmila is the youngest silicosis patient in Bhutpura. The 19-year-old lives a few streets away from Radha Bai with her parents and younger brother. She got sick when she was 12.
I've been getting medical treatment for 7 years, but I only heard about this disease for the first time when I came to the university hospital. Before that, I was given medication for lots of different diseases because the doctors didn't really know what I had. Sometimes they said this, sometimes that. I never got the right medication for my illness. That's the problem. That's why a lot of people die. And then I was finally told that I have silicosis.
Even as a young girl, Urmila would go to her mother's workplace after school and was exposed to the dust from the stones. At the age of 13, she started working there herself, even though it's actually illegal. But reality doesn't always abide by the law.
My mother was alone and couldn't afford to feed us and send us to school. So I had to drop out of school and started to work. There's only one private school nearby, but the fees are very expensive. How are poor people supposed to afford it?
Now, instead of working down in the valley with the paving stone carvers, Urmila goes to the offices of a local NGO every day. Along with 15 other girls, she's training to be a seamstress. Still, when they get home from the course in the afternoon, some of the girls are forced to pick up their hammers again and chip away at the rocks to earn money.
There should be more work for women and girls so that they don't need to chisel stones to make a living. I'm sick, but I don't want anyone else to get sick.
There are ways to prevent silicosis, for instance, by using water to absorb the dust. That's why dry drilling is prohibited in Rajasthan's mines. But few quarries enforce these rules. Special masks for the workers also make a huge difference. But the masks are expensive and very uncomfortable to wear in the heat. And often mine owners don't provide their workers with the right models. Rana Sengupta runs the non-profit Mine Labour Protection Campaign Trust. He says the only solution is stronger regulation in the sector.
But in the settlements where the mine workers are working on the cobbles, which is not a mine, which is not a factory, there's somebody who has dumped stone in front of your house. So there's a group of people who are working on the stones until it is cleared away. And there's some agent who comes and procures it from that site. You can't define it as a mine or a factory. They have to stop that kind of working. Either you have to work in a factory or into a mine. That is illegal.
Without official working contracts, workers can't demand employers to respect their rights to provide protective measures like masks, nor pay compensations. Of course, even with proper contracts, it's still unsure whether workers' rights are respected. But when there's no transparency at all, there's no chance for workers to improve their conditions. That's what consumers abroad should be aware of, Sengupta says.
In the supply chain, the German buyer has to ask the supplier, the last end supplier, to get the identity of the worker, to maintain records of the workers, whether it is in the factory or whether it is the mine.
At the end of the afternoon, Hira, Radha and the others walk to the hotel where the state governor is taking part in a meeting. The women have not eaten all day. They're hungry and tired. Some sit down on the floor. The others continue to chant their demands. The women even come up with new chants. Some are pushing their fists up in the air, laughing. For a moment, it seems as if they were having fun. Dusk is falling when finally an administrative officer from the city offices comes out to talk to them. She promises that next week, the compensation payments will get processed. For the first time, Hira Bai is a little optimistic.
I've been here quite a few times, at least 15 or 20 times. I've been coming every 4 or 6 weeks over the past 2 years, but so far no one has listened to us. I really do have hope now. I've been wishing for something to happen for so long. They've promised so many times. And now perhaps it really will happen next week.
That report by Yulia Wadawan in Rajasthan, India, was presented by Keith Walker. And that's all we've got time for this week. Just a reminder that you can find this and previous episodes at dw.com/worldlink, on SoundCloud under DW English, or on iTunes. And finally, if you have any feedback or story suggestions, just drop us an email to worldlink@dw.com or contact us on our Facebook page, DW Global Society. This week's show was produced by Loveday Wright and me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Christoph Grove. Thanks for listening and bye for now. Worldlink was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.